Do you know what the most requested item at homeless shelters all across the country is? It's socks. I didn't know that, and when I found that out, it made me sad. But it also made a lot of sense. At homeless shelters, new clothing is in extremely high demand. This fact is the driving force behind my friends at Bombas. Bombas exists to help support the homeless community and to bring awareness to an underpublicized problem in the United States. Bombas was founded on the philosophy of donating socks to those in need. But it's evolved to go deeper into the community. The more clothing items they sell, the more they donate. As they grow, their giving and community efforts will continue to grow right alongside them. Over 40 million acts of kindness. One purchase equals one donation. How many of us just go to a big box retail store and buy name brand socks without even second guessing it? Imagine if your purchase could support people in this country who need something as basic to us as a pair of warm, comfortable socks. Folks, do me a favor and go to bombas.com. That's BOMBAS.com. Head over and insert the code COMFORT at checkout to get 20% off your first pair of socks. Bombas covers all sizes, features great designs, including their upcoming holiday collection, and you'll be making a purchase that serves a basic human right and truly helps one of the greatest efforts in our country. That's bombas.com. BOMBAS.com. Welcome back to the show, Steve Grad. Thanks for hanging out with me tonight. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing?
I am doing well, and I'm looking forward to this. If anyone listening to this conversation tonight has seen an episode of Pawn Stars, I mean, obviously you're going to be very familiar for them. But, you know, for those that, for whatever reason, may have never seen the show, and really even for those that have, as we sort of get started here, can you give us a little about your education, your professional background?
Yeah. You know, I always say professional background because being in the business that I'm in, I think the professional background is just me growing up in the industry.
Yeah.
And also me growing up as a autograph guy, an autograph chaser. I was fortunate enough to live in Chicago, which made a huge difference in my life. Mm. And living in Chicago, you know, I started going to baseball games and being interested in, you know, getting autographs when I was 8, 9 years old. And that progressively led to celebrities and music and politics and, you know, you name it, and traveling all over the world to do this and enjoy a hobby and a business at times.
Yeah.
And just kind of morphed into being an authenticator. I think that I have a pretty good eye for what's good and what's bad. I definitely have areas of specialties, things that I'm really good at and things that I'm just not great at. And mm-hmm. you know, I could go into that some other time. I mean, that's, you can't know everything, you know, but I'm pretty good at most of the stuff that I do see on a daily basis. But I've been fortunate enough to be, I guess, the right place, the right time. And I was having this discussion a couple days ago with a friend of mine, and he's been in the business forever and he's been doing signings forever, starting back in the 80s. And he still does them all the time, but he's very active in the business still. I was kind of going over the years with him and different people. And he's like, my God, man, he's you've been associated with this for a long time. And I was very fortunate to meet kind of the right people at a really young age that help kind of push me in the right direction and kind of show me things. And, you know, going to card shows when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm 50 now. So those things made a big difference and eventually led to the authentication. And then there's always been this appetite for people to do TV shows and do different cool things. And we were presented many times when I was at PSA about doing a show. And I even filmed a few different things that just never kind of panned out.
Yeah.
In 2009, they started Pawn Stars show and they had actually asked PSA if they would have their autograph expert be on the show, and they declined at the time because they said they had another project in the works. And I guess, and really that never panned out, but at any rate they used Drew Max, who was local in Vegas. After about 2012 sometime, they'd gotten fed up with him, and he quite frankly wasn't very good at what he did. They knew that, they saw that. You know, anytime you see an autograph guy say I'm an autograph expert or I'm an autograph guy with forensic document on the back of that, you probably run away from him. So Drew, you know, and unfortunately, you know, subsequently he's passed away. Something happened to him in Vegas during March or April, some kind of incident where he ended up something in jail and then he ended up just dying. So
I didn't know that.
And that was the first guy that did it. But and he'd bring out the big magnifying glass and look at stuff. And most of the time he was pretty wrong in what he was doing on the show. So they knew they had to kind of get him off. 2013 rolls around right at the beginning, and I'm on the phone with a casting person in New York for the production team. And I think January 21st of 13, I had started filming with the show, and it ended up turning into, quite honestly, a pretty good run where I've been very fortunate. I mean, I'm not guaranteed anything past the next season, and who knows if there's another season, but I have been filming since July this year. So, and they wrap, I think, in December, something like that, where then they won't film for a while. And hopefully it's just very strange how it all works. I don't really understand all of it myself either, but you know, basically the network has to, like History Channel has to be getting good ratings to approve another season. So
yeah,
everyone's in flux. Hopefully it happens again and there's going to be another season of the show. I hope there is, but it's been a lot of fun doing it. I've been very fortunate. They use me. It's really strange. Like the guy who's the proudest, obviously, of doing the show is Mark Hall Patton.
Sure.
The Bearded Knowledge.
Sure.
A friend of mine, great guy. He had just filmed, I believe, his 250th episode or something like that.
Wow.
Just recently. I filmed myself about 140 to 160, somewhere in there. I kind of lost track after a while, but they're the expert. I guess I'm the one they've used the most over the last 4 or 5 years, even more than Mark, and he's local to Las Vegas. So it's been fun doing it. I've seen some great stuff. I've had some very unique encounters with sellers.
Yeah.
And as you know, people think they know everything too when you're dealing with them. I sure am not that person, but if it's an autograph piece, I'm brought in to look at it. I'm sure going to know about it, and I'm going to know if it's good or bad. And sometimes people, you know, they like to disagree.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked about, like, you know, kind of transitioning from collecting. And I know you still collect, but transitioning from collecting into sort of like the professional side of things. What was it about professional, you know, the world of signature authentication that made you want to flip from just, you know, collector and then kind of go to the other side as far as actually being a professional on it?
Well, you know, there was a need for it. And I think about, I'd say the 90s, they had so many problems with Operation Bullpen and so many fakes. And, you know, the term they used to use was the Wild Wild West, because that's what it was when you were buying autographs. It was very difficult to discern.
Yeah.
Unless you really knew who you were buying from and knew what you were doing. Now, is third party always correct? I'll be honest with you. No, it's not. There's mistakes that are made, but we're all human beings. And I think I accept that. I have to, as an authenticator, you have to be able to accept the fact that, yeah, you're going to make a mistake once in a while, learn from it, get better, don't do it again. About 2002, PSA DNA was at a point where they just had Jim Spence. Prior to that, when they started PSA DNA about 99, 2000, they had like a 4 or 5 guy panel. It really didn't work out. And they'd have to go to California once a month and look at stuff. Spence ended up taking it over about 2001, ran it out of his house in Pennsylvania. In 2002, some things happened where, you know, I was working at Master Auctions, but also I knew Jim from the industry, and we had kind of spent time when he would come in and look at the autographs for the auctions. They felt the need to add another staff member. So I ended up, you know, jumping on the PSA DNA. I had a pretty good knowledge of what I was doing. I had handled literally hundreds of thousands of autographs in my life up to that point. And he knew I had that experience, and it kind of worked out, you know, because before that, Jim was limited in his scope because he only knew so much, and he was keep trying to learning. But I will tell you, it is a challenging proposition to say, start learning modern autographs, because you're looking at guys, if you've seen some of the, even the insert cards, I mean, these guys just put a line on some of these things.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to discern that stuff, if it's good or bad. And we do the best we can. And you, through the years, build a staff that you could specialize in that. And then shortly thereafter at PSA, we started adding guys to the staff that could help us in that department too, because things are constantly evolving. You've got new autographs, you've got college rookies, you've got guys coming in the NFL, the NBA, you know, Quentin Richardson's a good example, played at DePaul, would have this beautiful autograph when he was in college, and he gets the pros and he just barely signs a cue. So they just change and evolve, and you've got to kind of follow those changes and stay on top of it. And I think that's been the biggest challenge. And obviously I left PSA DNA in September 2016. We started Beckett Authentication not long after, and kind of the rest is history. So I do enjoy that part of it, being an authenticator, being able to look at the autographs. It's challenging though. There's daily challenges. There's things I look at. I just had this happen the other day with a group of Richard Nixon balls, and they come from a, you know, the thing is, I don't really like to consider the source, but I know the guy who submitted them. And at the end of the day, I'm not going to certify them, but boy, I will tell you that the background, his background's impeccable, and the background of kind of where they were sourced from and how he ended up getting them back in the late 80s makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
At the same time, I just can't substantiate the signatures with anything I have in my exemplars, or the consultants I work with cannot back them up anywhere. So, you know, sometimes you got to, you know, take, I think that's the most important thing too, is taking a step back, and sometimes you just have to punt and just say goodbye to it and not get too emotionally involved because I've seen guys do that and guys get caught up too much in stuff. Yeah. And I've seen some huge mistakes made that way where guys just fall in love an authenticator with an item, believing it's so good. Sometimes you just overlook the fact that the item's actually fake, and it happens.
Yeah. And we'll definitely get into that a little bit more as we kind of go along, but you know, it's talking about, you know, your career and kind of going through it. I think for people that want to do what you do, sort of looking at your career and your success, and it's sort of like looking at a blueprint, because there's, you know, there's really not much you haven't done at this point. I mean, what's this ride been like for you? I mean, you have all the success, you know, before, I mean, Pawn Stars aside, you have all the success in your industry before Pawn Stars hits, and then it hits and it just takes off like a rocket ship. What's this whole ride been like for you thus far?
It's been pretty crazy. I look back and I look back to 02, and I could always look at it from this point of view. And this is something that the public doesn't, you know, fully see either. When I started, I'll just put in a context, when I had started with PSA DNA in 2002, as a whole for autograph authentication, I'll tell you what kind of infancy it was in. A year, they were generating right under $250,000. It wasn't even that, just in a year.
Yeah.
By the time I had left PSA DNA in 2016, we were at that 5 million mark a year. So, you know, we've taken it from such a huge leap. And now what we're doing at Beckett is even financially, at least, and kind of how we're succeeding in that regard is even bigger than what we did at PSA.
Yeah.
You know, and it's been a fun ride doing it. I think the one thing that I would tell you that I let be a distraction for years was the negativities for years. Because there's so much of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's rooted in jealousy.
Right.
It's rooted in people who have been slighted. They feel slighted, or guys that have been kind of ostracized from the business and they've kind of been very critical, or they'll jump down your throat. There's still many people out there that have a single goal of destruction at hand.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that that's the negative part of the business that I still am in every day, where I see people talking negatively. It's kind of died down a little bit. I'll say it's gotten a little better at times, but you know, I'm really don't like to discuss it, but last year I was involved in a court case that I won against an autograph dealer who calls himself the greatest authenticator ever, and ended up prevailing in that in Los Angeles last year. So
yeah.
People are out for blood. This is just autographs. But I noticed from a very long time ago is that they feel their livelihoods are at stake.
Right.
So if I'm rejecting stuff, obviously they're submitting it, or someone's submitting it, or someone buys out of their auction and it gets rejected repeatedly, they're, you know, on the attack. And there's been guys that will always be on attack. That's the negative part. Okay. I think that's a very small part. Mm-hmm. The positive part is being able to help people with their collections. It's help people that have authentic stuff, because I've gone to so many homes, so many places, so many businesses, and they've got all bad stuff up.
Yeah.
And they are convinced, man, this is great. I think one of the first experiences I had was back in 02. Guy in New York said, man, check out all my stuff. This is my basement, right? I'm looking around. I'm like, well, nothing's real here. And he had spent money in big, you know, he's wealthy, but he had spent money in Vegas. It was at one of the casinos, had one of those stores set up there.
Yeah.
And he was winning a lot of money, and he had a lot of money, and he'd walk in and say, I'm going to take this piece and this piece. He'd spend $250,000 a crack every few months when he went to Vegas.
Wow.
At the end of the day, he had nothing but garbage. And that happens all the time. I like to write people and don't want to lose people. I don't want people to walk away from the business because they got burned.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of fun to collecting. It prevails mostly in males, it seems like, but there are females that do collect this stuff too. But, you know, it seems like the stigma of my business is, oh, it's just a bunch of guys, you know, a bunch of, if you look at the comic book guy from The Simpsons,
yeah,
that's the business.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be honest with you. Part of it is that it's gotten a bad rap, but it's changed now. And things are definitely evolved, and guys wear suits, and, you know, there's a lot of businessmen that are in this business.
Yeah.
But I think the real positives, the positives outweigh the negatives. And I think the most important thing I learned, you know, probably 8-9 years ago, is I just turned it off. Mm. Just started taking the down, turned it off. If you guys want to be negative and come after me, feel free to do what you want. You want to lie, you want to make up stuff, that's your own prerogative. Usually, if you're a smart person, you're able to discern the truth from things that aren't the truth. It's much like in the news media when they're putting all this information out there, and sometimes not true on both sides of the spectrum. And that's the case with this too. They make up stuff and it gets to the point where they've got these web pages, you know, detailing all this stuff. And at the end of the day, most of it's not true. And people feel that I'm doing this job sometimes based to help people.
Yeah.
And I've always said, well, if that's the case, I mean, go look at my accounts, you know, I mean, please go ahead, sit down and look through what I have and what, you know, where my money's coming from. And I earn my money. I make my money being an authenticator. I don't make my money taking money from people to authenticate their bad stuff. And that's always one of the little stigmas that people always run back to. Oh, they just search stuff for their friends. Yeah. That's all they do. And they get paid extra.
Yeah.
It's not worth my reputation to do that. Drew Max, who I mentioned earlier, his reputation wasn't good in the business. In his track record on the show wasn't good. And the money he was actually physically costing Rick was extensive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he saw that and they saw that, you know. I think you just stay above the bar, you do your job and you do it well, and you do it to the best of your abilities, realizing that we're all going to make mistakes in life. Brooks Robinson, the best third baseman of all time. Ozzie Smith, the best shortstop of all time. Well, you know, they ended up making errors once in a while, making a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, you just learn from it. It's a great business to be in, though. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And you piggybacking off of what you're talking about with, you know, just Rick and the guys and the show and everything. I mean, what is your relationship like with Rick? You seem like you guys have a really great relationship on the show. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
I'm really glad you said that. It's funny. It started from day one when I went there to film, and it's blossomed. And he wanted me on the show a long time before that.
Yeah.
And he knew we just, I don't know. It's just weird. Sometimes, you know, you just meet someone and you hit it off perfect. And I won't lie to you. You know, we hang out a lot, gone to many meals together.
Yeah.
You know, I've been up to his vacation property up in Oregon and spent time with him away from the show at his home and just had a really good time being with him and learning from him. The guy, you know, once in a while, I'll go to dinner and I'll say, all right, I'm going to give you a subject. Tell me what you think about it. And he could just talk about it for hours.
Yeah.
And that's what I like about him. And if you had a chance and if people haven't, I always, there's a lot of episodes I say are cool, but the one that I really point to was from almost a year ago, last December, we did an episode based mostly on Star Wars stuff.
Oh, sure.
And we shot in England. And that really gives you an idea of our friendship and relationship. And we had a great time on the trip, but we also had a great time filming the stuff. And it was just a great time and a great experience, something I'll never forget. But if you really watch it and say, oh God, those guys are buddies. Well, you know what? We really are. And when people mention that to me, I really appreciate it because we are friends. At the end of the day, I'm friends with Rick, but I don't do any special favors for him. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the sellers are more pissed off at me for what I say about their item. But that, the end of the day, that's just the truth. You know, there's a famous one. It goes around the internet all the time. A guy had a Led Zeppelin album and it was gorgeous. And it had all four members of Zeppelin, including John Bonham, who passed away many years ago.
Yeah.
But he had three of them on one side of the album. And I think he had maybe like Jimmy Page or Plant on the other side. And I said, well, if this album had all four on the front, it would be worth a lot more. And I even gave him examples and it didn't matter. The scene's still up there. The guy was just livid about it.
Yeah.
And I think I proved it to him by auction sales and everything. He just didn't want to hear any of it. And
right.
I'm not basing it based on what Rick thinks or anybody else thinks. I base my value and an assessment of an item on what I think. And I work really hard at it. I want to make sure I get the prices right. I'm not trying to lowball or undercut people, but a lot of times people just think their stuff is worth more than it really is.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And speaking of the show a little bit, I mean, what we see as viewers on the show, it's often a little bit of what actually happens, I mean, throughout the process. I mean, can you walk us through sort of a typical day of shooting a segment of the show for you? Do they have you come in and knock out a bunch of items in one shot? Or are you constantly coming back to do an item here and there? Like, what's that process like?
It's some of it's complicated. I can't talk about all of it, with you. But we do set stuff up where I'm able to come in for consecutive days at least and be able to get some stuff done. Or will they could call me up and say, hey, come on down and film this item. And you know what? I tell you what, a lot of the stuff we have to retake is because of the sellers. And a lot of times, you know, just think about this, you know, how comfortable would you feel with three cameras in your face?
Yeah.
No. And another four or five people standing around watching you. It could be very uncomfortable. So we do have to film stuff kind of repeatedly. And sometimes you film with older people who don't really understand what in God's name is going on. Mm-hmm. That does happen. It's happened quite frequently. You work with them, but stuff does take a long time. Now with COVID, you know, the new episodes that'll start coming out, I think after November 16th, you'll see how there's different precautions taken, you know, including people in the store, shields up, all that type of thing. So there's right. more precautions taken for all the stuff, and they are really active about that, but they still want to be able to do the show. I would say that, you know, the interaction we have there is it's natural always. And I mean, obviously you have to reshoot stuff or something gets messed up. If the seller, it's usually the seller is really nervous,
yeah,
or says things that don't make sense. Sometimes the seller, they make statements one way and another way. It's about the item and the value. It becomes a mess. So yeah, of course they have to reshoot and do stuff, but a lot of those details I can't mm-hmm. get too specific about, other than the fact that I always tell people, you know, that genuineness you see of especially Rick, I mean, that's there,
yeah.
you know, any item you want to go on and talk about, it's all sitting up somewhere in his brain. And it's because he doesn't sit on the internet all day
right.
and mess around. The guy reads books like a madman. He reads about everything. He could talk about, obviously, Albert Einstein and World War I and World War II, no problem.
Yeah.
But he could also tell you how to put together an engine or a motor or build something more efficiently. And he does that stuff all the time. Or how to power a home, you know, off solar energy, and what he's doing and the different ways he does it. And that's all up in his head. It's very fascinating. I think it comes across in the show, usually is very genuine. And Chumlee has gotten much better too. He's, you know, obviously changed his looks. And
yeah.
I think the more you're on TV, you're conscious of, like, saying, if you look at the early days of those guys, of Chumlee and Corey, I mean, those guys weren't looking too good.
Yeah.
So they've changed their looks a lot. And it shows, you know, and Chumlee's much more confident in what he's doing, and he's been great to work with. And I shoot with Chumlee a lot, just the two of us. And
yeah.
I think it goes pretty well most of the time.
Yeah. And, you know, what I love about Pawn Stars, and what really kind of initially got me hooked on it back in when the show first started, is, you know, I'm a history freak. I mean, I've been studying history my whole life. We just wrapped this Amelia Earhart project, this documentary, which we actually shot with Mark Hall Patton for a year ago or so. And we're in the middle of sort of developing the documentary. What I love about the show and your role in it is you're taking your ability and really the vast knowledge base that you have for this, and you're applying it to historical authentication. So you've been involved in some of the coolest, you know, historical moments in the show. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how big a market there is for historical memorabilia, signatures in particular, right now. And do we expect that market to increase, you think?
Yeah, well, I've seen it increase greatly. I mean, one of the coolest, earliest items I shot in season 1 was the Beatles' first contract.
Yeah.
And it technically was their second, but it was their first official deal. Their manager, Brian Epstein, their first contract was handwritten. Mm-hmm. And he said, if I get you a record deal in the year, we were going to tear this up and get a real deal. And they did it. And I think 3 of the 4 had co-signers. Their parents had to co-sign the deal with them.
Yeah.
But we had that in, and we filmed it during season 1. And obviously the guy wanted a ton of money. I didn't think at the time it was worth that. I'm still not sure it is. I mean, stuff like that is always going to hold value. Your iconic people,
yeah,
or people that have that, you know, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, and then John Kennedy, people like that, Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan,
yeah,
always going to be popular to collect. And believe it or not, as polarizing as a human being as he is, Donald Trump is mm-hmm. very popular for collectors. And then on the other hand, you always have the iconic people like Monroe and, you know,
yeah,
the movie stars of the past, Jack Nicholson and Clint Eastwood, Harrison Ford, Star Wars, stuff like that's
yeah.
always going to be iconic and collectible. I still see that stuff going up, and just not that stuff, but I see the historical stuff obviously has moved up the ladder quite significantly. I think George Washington is one of the ones. Thomas Jefferson,
yeah,
his signature has gone up exponentially over the last few years. And because I think the people still collect that stuff very much, because the presidents is, if you think about it, is an easy set to put together. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. You have to find them all. But if you say, I want to collect a document from each president, you could pretty much do that all the way through Carter, mm-hmm. roughly Reagan. And it gets harder after that, but you could put together pieces from all those presidents. It's an easy set of, I believe, 46 mm-hmm. presidents. So you're able to put that together. People like to collect in that mentality. Baseball Hall of Famers, they want to collect all of them. Football Hall of Famers, they want to collect all of them.
Sure.
Collectors are based like that. I collect like that too with Star Wars or Indiana Jones or different things I enjoy. So that's very easy. And I think those values arise. Music stuff, if it's important music, mm-hmm. if it's The Who, The Rolling Stones, The Beatles. Think about all those bands in the 60s, you know, that brought us the British invasion.
Yeah.
And then brought us mostly rock and roll, more or less, to the United States. Obviously, you had Elvis and you had Chuck Berry and you had Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins. But then you had the British invasion in the 60s. And then the late 60s, you had, you know, Hendrix, you had Janis Joplin, you had the, you know, that whole thing, the Doors.
Yeah.
And then the 70s, things changed with these other bands people grew up with the Eagles, Journey, Boston, Fleetwood Mac. And then the 80s, it changes with different bands people follow, like Metallica and Black Sabbath and different bands. And the evolution changes. But the thing that's great about the music part of it is it's something we're always going to listen to.
Yeah.
So it's something that my children listen to music from the 60s. And people want to collect that because they enjoy it. Now you know, you turn 40 years old and you've got a lot of money and you want to spend it on cool stuff you listen to and buy signed albums and photos. So that's why that marketplace will always be there.
Yeah.
It won't be there always for stuff like, you know, Rudolph Valentino or Charlie Chaplin,
right.
Who are names I know, but you know, quite honestly, most people don't know those people anymore. They kind of fade away. Cary Grant will fade away a little more. And Clark Gable, you know, they all tend to fade away and their values don't really go up exponentially through the years because it's harder to find collectors that want that stuff. But Gone or not Gone with the Wind, but that's a good one too. But
yeah,
a Wizard of Oz is an easy set to put together. It's not easy, but you could find all the signatures. That still remains pretty popular, but we see that film on TV all the time. Jimmy Stewart, he's on every Christmas ad nauseum. So we're going to see that, and his signature remains very popular because of that. Elvis Presley, you know, had the entire 60s where he just did movies, and that stuff is still all out there. So you have that popularity that remains with these people to this day. And I think the music thing to me is the one that I always look to.
Yeah.
People always are going to listen to Led Zeppelin, period.
Yeah.
Never going to change. People are always going to listen to the Beatles. Their music's always going to be there.
Yeah.
So their stuff's always going to be collectible and their prices are going to continue to go up, which they have. And I would say not exponentially, but year by year, they keep rising and rising. The Beatles have cooled off a pinch, but you know, they're going to go up too at a time when Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr go away.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't want to even think about that, but yeah, that's going to happen.
I don't either.
You know, in piggybacking off what you're just talking about, I often hear you talk about provenance on the show. I mean, when it comes to, you know, historical autographs, especially ones from so long ago, how important, you know, is having that paper trail or some kind of provenance to help authenticate a piece and just adding to that piece in general?
Well, I added two ways. Okay. I think that provenance is important if you're a collector.
Yeah.
It's more important. So, and especially stuff like, I just had this conversation last week, collecting hair, presidential hair. John Reznikoff, who is a friend of mine, has the largest presidential hair collection, but he doesn't have many of them. It's like 12 or 13. You need that lineage with it and it helps. You know, autographs, it's important. Is it vital? No.
Yeah.
And from my point of view, I want to look at the autograph. Okay. I don't want to look at the provenance.
Yeah.
So when I looked at the Richard Nixon balls, which I was having trouble with the other day, I wanted to look at those first and see what I could do and see what I could match. Cause I've seen these balls through the years, but I had eight of them in front of me. And then I said, okay, tell me the background. I'm interested in knowing because I've seen enough of them through the years and even had a few in my files that I've saved. So tell me more about it and stuff like that might help. In this case, I'm going to decide not to do that and be able to authenticate them. I'm just going to pass on it, but it does help from time to time. I think it's very important to not have it though. When you originally see an autograph or something comes in, it doesn't come into play. And I'll give you an example. I'd say about 5 or 6 years ago when I was at PSA, a customer submitted what he viewed as a very high-end piece. It was a baseball with Babe Ruth's signature on the sweet spot.
Yeah.
But on the side panel was Al Capone. And the Ruth signature was unquestionably real to me. It clicked everywhere where Ruth had to click. It was perfect to me. No problem. The Capone signature, well, quite frankly, it looked very much like his autograph. But in my files, and maybe there might be one or two somewhere else, I don't have many Capones to go off of. Most of them are legal type documents from either a prison, a jail, or maybe a stock type thing he did.
Yeah.
And there might be 10 known or maybe 8. I could be high on that. It could be low, but it's in that ballpark. But I've still not seen him sign Al Capone. And I was very intrigued by it because some of the signature had his qualities to it. The ink was definitely a lot older. So I said, tell me about this ball because I'd have to know, because just if you just use common sense, Al Capone wasn't a guy that was walking around signing autographs for people. If he was, I'd see it. You'd see a scorecard. He went to baseball games. You'd see a napkin signed. You'd see a piece of paper signed. You'd see an autograph book signed somewhere, because he was out in the public a lot, especially in Chicago.
Yeah.
He was in Florida. You'd see something. There's no doubt in my mind something would have popped up. Or when I say something, I'd say five or six things would have popped up. I would have just seen him through the years, and really nothing exists like that.
Yeah.
So I started keep looking at it. This would tell me the story, and certain parts of the story made no sense. And they involved baseball players that weren't there, or a manager that was dead already, Miller Huggins. And I just said, you know what? I said, I the signature, I can't verify and back up and fully stand behind the Babe Ruth. I can, well, I'm just going to have to take a pass. That's one where I punted it away. Could Capone have been real? Oh God, maybe an offshoot date. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he wasn't the type of guy. First of all, just, you know, he was friends with Gabby Hartnett. I think he gave Gabby Hartnett, former Cub catcher, Hall of Famer, I think he gave him a gun at one point or something engraved to him. I think that, as a story goes, I think I've seen it somewhere. Yeah. And it was given to him, you know. But still, I don't think Gabby Hartnett was going to be asking him to sign something, or any other player. It just wasn't something guys did back then.
Yeah.
It wasn't a practice from then. It just wasn't something players were running around like guys do now. You know, guys now are running around trying to get other guys' jerseys and autographs and stuff like that. They collect it now. But back then, that wasn't something that's a common sense thing. And also, you know, Al Capone wasn't walking around doing it. So I just passed on it. So, you know, providence does help, but it doesn't always push something over the finish line. The autograph's got to speak for itself too.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of that, I mean, what I really love about you is that when you're brought in sort of authenticate something on the show in particular, and it surprises you or it excites you. I mean, you wear that expression, which I think is great, because for someone of your stature, I mean, it shows that, you know, man, you're deep into your career and you still have that love for it. I mean, where do you think that love comes from after all this time?
It's probably from, I could always hark back to the first time I went to a baseball card show. Mm. It's wide open, and just seeing all that. And I think it that passion started there. And, you know, all through the years, and just being so excited about the stuff. I want to see the next great thing.
Yeah.
I want to see the thing that's going to blow me away more than the thing that did before. I still always say to people, they say, oh, what's the coolest item you've ever seen? Well, okay, let me think about that for a minute.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously seeing the Beatles contract was really neat. But to me, it was even more, it was less money. And it's something that I don't even know where it's at anymore. It was probably sold. But when John Belushi died, the week or so, 10 days before he died, he checked in the Chateau Marmont in Beverly Hills. And, you know, they had him fill out a card, you know, his guest card. And years later, they were just getting rid of all their files. And a lady that worked there, she grabbed that one and said, I'm going to keep that one. Eventually, she submitted it to PSA when I worked there. And that still might be one of the coolest things I've ever seen, even though I've authenticated a million and a half dollar items. That one really stands up there. I mean, Jackie Robinson's contract, his first contract to play baseball, I authenticated. The guys that owned it said, you know, it's worth $40 million or whatever. And wow. It's not, but I don't think it's sold in auction when it's sold, but it's a really neat piece. I'm very proud to have authenticated that.
Yeah.
You know, but I've been able to authenticate some really neat stuff, some historical stuff, obviously Lincoln and Washington and the presidents, but those little things stick out to me. The John Belushi thing sticks out to me. It's like, man, that is really cool.
Yeah.
Or when I see a Babe Ruth signed in ballpoint pen compared to pencil or fountain pen.
Yeah.
Ruth, at least, you know, his chosen pen was a fountain pen. The ballpoint wasn't truly something that was in wide use when Ruth was alive, though. It was there just right in that World War II cusp. So 44, 45. You know, Ruth died 48. So it was around, but it wasn't used that much. And Ruth sure didn't use it a lot. But man, when I see one, I get excited for it, because it's like, that's a cool piece to see. It's really neat, fascinating.
Yeah.
I just see weird stuff from time to time. But, you know, sometimes I'll be honest too, it all kinds of, you know, sometimes it blends together. You know, I get to see so much neat stuff. It's not that I'm saying I don't appreciate it, but at the same time, sometimes it's like, all right, blow me away with something new. And I think, like, when we did the Star Wars stuff in England, there was stuff that day that we didn't shoot with. That was, I think it was, I mean, I was holding in my hands, at least for a Star Wars fanatic like me, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill's contracts for Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, their original contract.
Yeah.
But I did get to hold George Lucas's handheld, you know, his handwritten script for Star Wars, which it would be like finding the first script for Gone with the Wind or something
Yeah.
along those lines, because
It's the Holy Grail.
it was, and I was holding it. I'm like, are you sure? Yeah, you could hold that. So I do
Yeah.
get to see stuff like
Wow.
that, and I do get excited for it because that's what I do. I mean, I'm not going to get, let's be honest, I'm not going to get excited for like a Danny Werfel signed mini helmet. You know, that stuff isn't going to excite me. But when I see
Yeah.
stuff that has historical significance, or I knew that John Kennedy wrote out this entire book, or the inscription that's really neat, I like stuff like that, or a whole letter signed by a Christy Mathewson letter, or stuff like that really does get me excited. It's really neat to see it, and I do feel like I'm holding history in my hands for the most part.
Yeah.
Obviously, let's be honest, when I'm holding a Linda Blair 8x10 from The Exorcist, that's not really history. It's just her writing some ridiculous sentiment and signing it. But when you really
Yeah.
history in your hands, that's special. And I will tell you, it comes at the oddest places. You know, I could be in Kansas City, or I could be in Detroit, or I could be in Seattle, and someone will have something cool, and it always turns out that way. And I'm
Yeah.
just always fascinated to know what's gonna walk in next, what's gonna be next, like what is that guy gonna bring? I don't know a lot of times. So,
Yeah.
and the same way with the show, there'll be so many cool items that come on the show and we get to do. You know, there's going to be an item this season. I can't talk about it, but I spent a ton of time just sitting. I had to delay shooting for, I was just blown away by it, but I also had to spend some time, you know, really, I
Yeah.
want to make sure I was right about it. So there's stuff that happens like that. It was really neat though. So I love that stuff like that. So I do have a passion for it. And obviously when you mold your career around doing what I do, if I was 10 years old and someone said, hey, someday you're going to get paid to authenticate autographs and then you're going to be on TV, I would have said, sure,
Yeah,
whatever you say.
right. Yeah.
And then that happened. So I'm very fortunate for that to have happened. Right place, right time. But I also believe that I definitely put in my time. And I think you did ask me about, or just referred to it. You know, a lot of people ask me about, hey, I want to do your job. What do I need to do?
Yeah.
It's so hard to explain, but it's not just looking at a signature and looking back and forth and saying, okay, one's good, one's bad. There's the experience and being in the business and learning the industry and then learning autographs and learning guys' tendencies and how they signed and how they didn't sign and which direction they signed, what kind of pressure they applied, you know, what kind of pressure they apply when they use a fountain pen, a ballpoint pen, a pencil. You have to start figuring all that stuff out. And I think most of the work now that I do with the really tough stuff, the vintage stuff, it all comes down to just detective work and just figuring it out and looking at it a lot closer and just letting it sit in your head. So,
Yeah.
you know, I know it, I could go on and on for forever. You know,
That's what I
it's not,
love.
I will tell you, I'll tell you this much, it's not an easy business to just say, oh, I'm just going to get into this as an authenticator.
Yeah. Yeah.
It takes a lot more than that. And now, you know, you have guys obviously that are out there for years. They try to fool you. This past summer, the Detroit bust that happened
Yeah.
up in Michigan, in Traverse City,
Right.
still to me will be pretty amazing. I've heard some of the stuff the feds have already accumulated, and auction records and all the stuff he kept. So I had been seeing his stuff for many, many years. I'll tell you the truth, the thing that's really frustrating to me, and I also respect the fact how they do this, but you know, the feds were notified of this guy probably about 2002, three range. I'd say 2002. I had worked with the FBI on many occasions when I worked at PSA, including Tim Fitzsimmons, and then also the people who were involved in the other Chicago stuff with Mastro Auctions and Bill Mastro and all that. But I've spoken with them and sat with these people and said, here's what you have to look for. And this is this guy that's doing it. Hopefully I helped him in some way or another. And
Yeah.
I had definitely shared my files with the feds on it. And I'd love to see that story grow. I mean, people just don't know how severe this was. And I always go back to the fact that if this guy hadn't gotten, I always call it the Mendoza line. Mario Mendoza was a, you know, 200 hitter. Let's say he hit 180. It's like Mo Berg. You know, Mo Berg was an awful baseball player, but you know, he served another purpose. He was a spy as well, but that's a whole other story. But
Right.
Mario Mendoza, I mean, the guy couldn't hit, but he'd still stick around, a guy who had 200 every year. So I think the guys that survive, that forge, they stay kind of above, below that Mendoza. They stay, you know, people would say to me, oh, no one's forging Ken Boyer.
Yeah.
Well, sure they are.
Yeah.
No one's forging Norm Cash. Hey, no one's forging this football player who died in 1978. Well, actually, they are. they're very active about it because that keeps them under the Mendoza line. So if they're selling stuff consistently for years, just imagine at $200, $300, $150, they're able to stay a certain line.
Yeah.
And that's how they make their business and that's how they make their money. But then the Henkel guy who just was busted, he kind of went above the Mendoza line and he was floating there and feeling good. But then he went really far above it. And he said, I'm going to do artwork and I'm going to start duplicating artist work. And then he got caught. You know, when pieces sell like for $290,000, $300,000, $150,000, artwork that's never been seen by anybody, but all of a sudden, hey, just discovered.
Yeah.
Oh, God, guess what? Found this in a shed or this was discovered at an antique mall or something.
Yeah.
That type of thing, that's what got him caught. And that's what usually gets the guys caught when they think they could screw around in that territory because you don't last long. And Henkel survived for a long time doing Ty Cobb and Babe Ruth and the Beatles and different autographs. And then one day he said, I'm going to just keep getting more bolder. And then that's when he got nabbed. Mm. And I'm happy to see it happen. That was a big one for our industry.
Yeah.
I couldn't have been more happy. It was really ironic. Right after that, I was at a client's and he goes, man, you've got to see this great piece I've got to pick up. It was Walt Disney, Mickey Mouse sketch signed by Walt Disney at an early age.
Good Lord.
Yeah, exactly. I took one look at it and I said, that's from Henkel. That's fake.
Mm.
And he, what do you mean? He's like, I paid $20,000 for this.
Oh, man.
I said, you should have shown me before you bought it. And I said, I hope you can get your money back. I think he did, but it had all of his earmarks. And the more I'd looked through the years at his stuff, it had all of his earmarks on it.
Mm.
He just was consistent in that regard. And Babe Ruth is an autograph. I always tell people this. He was consistently inconsistent, but Ruth had earmarks within his signature that I know that I could go to every time and look at and know where they're at. This guy got some of them actually, but then he would miss up stuff. He would screw up inscriptions all the time. Mm. Ruth had several different ways to inscribe stuff. This guy did a whole mix mosh of them, but it looked good.
Yeah. And you know, we've kind of hammered this home a lot tonight, but I think it's important because as you talk about, there's really sort of a science to authentication and kind of getting this right. I guess the obvious question is what can casual collectors do to ensure that, you know, they aren't victimized by sellers that are pushing off replications, bad products, everything you've talked about tonight? What can they do?
You're talking about the casual buyer maybe, or even let's say someone that's been semi-experienced in the business, because I've seen both levels, by the way.
Sure.
I've seen people that have been around for a while get burned, and I've seen people that just start and get burned. I mean, first of all, if it's too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true.
Yeah.
And that's usually the case. You know, when you're buying a Mickey Mouse signed sketch for $20,000 signed by Walt Disney back in the 30s or whatever it was.
Yeah.
That's something that I think would be at auction at maybe $50,000 to $100,000 minimally.
Yeah.
So you gotta first look at that. And another thing is that drives me crazy. And this is one of my biggest pet peeves. It's when someone tries to sell you on something so hard, they really want to prove it to you.
Yeah.
And I get this with the autographs all the time. Guy wants to really prove it. Hey, I know this is good. I'll tell you why. And they want to try and prove it to you. That's usually someone to stay away from. I mean, if the autograph speaks for itself, which it should, you shouldn't have someone have to even prove it to you even more. It's like a used car salesman that's got to even push that car even more.
Yeah.
It's got to be a lemon. I mean, you're trying to get this on my hands and I showed a little interest. I mean, that's one thing that's driven me crazy through the years of people that push stuff incessantly bad. That's in bad. And they know it's bad. And, you know, common sense is a big thing. You know, it sometimes eludes all of us in life. It happens. But use common sense.
Yeah.
That's because it's a great tool to use.
Yeah.
And I know some people don't have common sense. They don't. They just, it's not something they were born with. But my God, just use a little of it because it goes a long way. And then also, obviously, the obvious things is, you know, authentication is huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether you decide to use PSA, that's your choice, or JSA, that's your choice. I hope you use Beckett. I spent a lot of years building the brand of PSA DNA. I'm very proud of what I did there.
Yeah.
You would have a lot of faith in the stuff that I did when I was there. I'd have no problems with that. At Beckett, we're building this brand and doing authentication. I think that helps. And when people say to me, well, hey, I got Carl Yastrzemski in person at a show myself. I'm not getting it certified. I said, okay, that's fine. So he's going to put up on eBay and he's going to get $40 for it.
Mm-hmm.
But look, then the certified ones sell for $100, $125. And so for that investment and not being ridiculously stupid like that, you're going to get more money. It's proven because that the end seller, the end buyer, excuse me, they want that. They're demanding it now. That's why our landscape has changed. Okay. That's the, and I mentioned the Wild West. That's why the whole landscape changed.
Yeah.
It changed in those years. You know, I'd say right around the Barry Helper sale of 99, right after that, it changed significantly because that's what these people are demanding now. Does that come with a letter? Is that authentication? Is that authenticated? I'll give you a great example.
Yeah.
For years and years, you know, I really consider it, it's a great place to go to, you know, overseas, Europe, huge autograph markets in Paris, Germany, London, huge collectors, massive, gigantic collectors. I really feel the birth of autographs, obviously, is definitely not in the United States. They really were collecting there far, far many more years than people were here. I mean, signed albums were being done back in the 50s and 60s in England. People didn't catch on to that in the United States until the late 70s, 80s. So, you know, they kind of were the trendsetters, autograph books and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Really, to me, began there. But there's really no authentication there. There's a guy over there that does it who's not good, but he's very bad at it. But it's not really something that was there. So for years, when I was at PSA, we get an occasional submission. And I always said, hey, we need to go over there and do a show. Well, never really worked out. One of my goals was when we started back at Authentication was to start getting over to Europe and build a base there. So it took, I think, June 2017 or 18, we started doing shows there. And it's been a really slow process. And as you could imagine, it's not cheap to fly 2-3 people over there.
Right.
It's not cheap to stay for 5 to 7 days. It's not cheap to set up at shows. It's not cheap to bring supplies and do all that stuff. So it's very expensive.
Yeah.
So we took some hits, but as we started building it, people started demanding it more. And then right at the same time, Facebook pages started becoming so prevalent in autograph buying and selling. And it wasn't like that. I'd say even four years ago, it was not like that. They have become a focal point for buyers and sellers. Matter of fact, people mostly go to Facebook now to look for autograph pieces because there's so many groups that offer it. And I'm part of Star Wars Autograph Universe, which is a massive autograph site of Star Wars collectors and other collectors.
Yeah.
And great marketplace for autographs there. And people go to that now compared to eBay or Amazon or their local dealer. Mm. So all of that together, it's kind of exploded. And then now we're building a brand in England where people in England, before they could sell their Alec Guinness signed Obi-Wan Kenobi photo, they know it's certified or it's going to sell for $300 less.
Yeah.
So it's changed the dynamic very much. And I'm very respectful of it. I appreciate it very much. People have choices in what they want to use. And, you know, right now I feel a lot of people in the industry are using our brand and our company to sell their product and it's helping them. So that's very gratifying.
Yeah. You know, and we talked about some of the stuff earlier that stands out in the autograph industry and kind of what's always going to bring in, you know, top dollar or it's going to be consistent. Is there a next big thing in the autograph industry? I mean, I think that's something that everybody probably asks you all the time. Is there something that people should be looking out for, maybe getting into specifically that, you know, if they want to try collecting for the first time, or if they're an experienced collector and they want to shift into a different market, maybe?
Well, I think the market that seems like it's really hot is trading cards.
Yeah.
You know, the Mike Trout for $4 million, the, you know, LeBron James cards, all that stuff. I think that stuff is really starting to take a foothold in the business. It's weird. Things shift. People go to game used stuff. They get away from it. They want vintage cards.
Yeah.
But one of the big reasons that PSA has been so incredibly successful in grading cards is because they developed a registry. And that set registry has driven their business through the years, and it's been very successful for them. And they've been able to build off of that. But, you know, the great thing I've seen is that the Beckett brand to me has been interesting because for years I've known about it. I've always known since I've been a kid. I had the magazines. I grew up with it. And Dr. Beckett, who started it all, I was on his podcast recently. We talked about it. I said, you're an innovator. You're a guy I knew about. That brand is great to be part of. And it's really one of the biggest brands in my industry is Beckett.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I think people see that now and they're seeing what these cards are going for. You know, I call it new shiny stuff because that's what it is. And it's going for great money. And I see that Beckett name on there and I'm very proud of it because it's whether it's being shown on CNN or ABC News like it has recently or the New York Times or Forbes. There's been so much about it. And because people are actually saying, well, I'm not going to put my money in the stock market. I'm going to kind of switch gears and put it into this product. The autograph wise, I don't know. That's a good question because to tell you the truth, I worry about stuff getting watered down too much.
Yeah.
Something getting too hot, getting too watered down. And it's happened in many of the different areas of the business. And people always talk about what's collectible. I always feel Star Wars will be collectible, by the way. It just depends what you collect within it. I always think there's going to be good value with that. But same thing with the Avengers or Marvel and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff's always going to have pretty good value. And, you know, you have still a few holdouts that have never done shows, like Robert Downey Jr., Scarlett Johansson, have never actually sat down and signed for people and done a show. So the only chance people have is to buy secondhand from chasers and stuff like that. Mm. So I don't know. I think as things evolved, I still think people are going to love that stuff. They want to sign posters or they want a photo.
Yeah.
And the success of those shows over the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years has just gone crazy. The photo ops, you know, people pay more for the photo ops than the autographs now.
Yeah.
And I thought years ago, I think it was in 2002 or three, Val Kilmer was doing the Hollywood show.
Yeah.
And I said, Val Kilmer's doing a show? I said, oh, what, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Because Val Kilmer's doing a show. And he was, doing photo ops as well.
Wow.
For $30 or whatever it was. And it was in at the Beverly Garland Hotel in Burbank, right off the 101 freeway. And I was at the show and there's Val Kilmer signing autographs and taking photo ops. I'm like, huh. And then all of a sudden, promoters are like, well, instead of you reaching across the table and taking a photo with Wilt Chamberlain or whoever it was back then, you know, you're going to have to pay an extra fee to get in a booth and take a professional photo. Mm-hmm. And that's how this has all changed. It's exploded. So
yeah.
I don't think, you know, once COVID, we figure out COVID and it's looking positive. And get that under wraps, that stuff will start coming back and people start going out again and when they feel comfortable and doing those shows and appearances. So I think that's something to look forward to. And I think that's a trend that's kind of died right now, but it will pick back up at some point.
You know, as I'm hearing you talk about everything tonight, it, you know, kind of before we head out and as we wrap up, I want to end on this note because we have a lot of young folks that listen to the podcast. And you know, it's funny, my next door neighbor, who is a massive fan of yours, I didn't know this. I told him you were going to be on the show and he like about lost his shit when I told him you're going to be on the show. And, you know, and he's 16 years old and he's been collecting himself for a few years now. You know, for not only for him, but just for people that are in his position, you know, younger people that want to get into this. I'd love it if you could just talk to young folks like him that want to do what you do. What advice do you give them about getting into this industry and then being a success at it? I mean, what does it take? You've grinded for so many years at this, but what would you tell them?
I would say have a passion and make sure you're in the right direction. Find the right people to be around or at least look up to and find the people that are that walk the straight and narrow, not the guys that are in the back alleys. And I think the passion is the most important thing, but don't get discouraged because it is, truthfully, it is not easy to get started in really in any business. You know, I worked in radio for years, but the only way I could really get into radio, I'd heard for years in my classes in college would say, oh, well, you're going to have to go apply at the small station. Mm. So I lived in Chicago. You're going to have to go to Rockford or you're going to have to go to Joliet or even smaller. You might have to go to downstate Illinois or Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm like, oh God, really? But I found a way, a backdoor in by interning and getting in the Chicago market. My first job in radio, I was on the radio in Chicago. So instead of me doing all this stuff to bypass it, I worked, but I did the internships. I did 3 or 4 of them. I put all my time in. And you can't expect instant success from your work. You have to let it nurture. People have to get to know you and trust you and feel comfortable with you. And I remember years ago walking those shows as a young kid, no one knew me. And then years later, walking those shows, and although I know he's gone through a lot of legal problems, Bill Mastro was a very good friend of mine, and someone I've known since the early 90s. And Bill and I were at a show in 2000 or whenever it was 2001, and he walked me around to every dealer and told them, make sure you know this guy. And some I did, some I didn't. But that helped me out a lot. You need someone that's going to help you, that's going to nurture you through it, but you just can't expect instant success. And you also have to build trust. You just can't expect to pop in instantly.
Yeah.
And people have all this trust and faith. It's very difficult to do that. And I put in my time working at PSA all those years. And it was very difficult at times. And it was very grueling. And you had to build people's trust. In 2005, Jim Spence left to form his own company. And then we had to rebuild it all back up again. So it takes a long time. And I would definitely say, you know, find the things you enjoy doing and try and excel at it. And I've been lucky enough, like I said, as a kid, I was running around the ballpark getting autographs. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing as a little kid. But eventually I learned how to excel at it. I met the right people and I used common sense. And I had, be honest with you, I don't have book smarts. It was never my thing. But I think I have street smarts.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. If you want to have book smarts, that's great. Learn all kinds of things, but you have to have street smarts too. And going out and doing it, experiencing is something you have to do. And if you want to be an authenticator, you got to go out and do it. You can't just say, well, I studied autographs at home and I met Lou Ferrigno at a show once. That just doesn't count. Mm. You really got to go hit the bricks and you have to earn it. And that's the most important thing. I still feel that like every day I'm still kind of, you know, earning my job, obviously, and making money. But, you know, I'm still out there working and letting people see my body of work and what I'm doing. And I'm very proud of it. And it's, I mean, come on, man. I get to authenticate autographs. I mean, when people say, hey, what do you do?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm an autograph authenticator. Okay, what's that?
Yeah.
Because no one really, you know, you can get an Uber and an Uber driver's heard of a paralegal and a lawyer and a janitor, but they've not heard of a guy who authenticates autographs.
Yeah, sure.
And for your neighbor, I would definitely tell him all those things and just be passionate about it. But realize just having a passion about it isn't going to be good enough. You know, you're going to get knocked down a lot. You got to get back up and keep doing it and stay determined. So that's the best way I could sum it up.
A great way to wrap up the show. Now, as we exit tonight, we want to, of course, we want to end our discussion with a very well-known tradition here on the show that, of course, began with the creation of this questionnaire by French television host Bernard Pivot. And it was made, anybody who's ever seen Inside the Actor's Studio and James Lipton,
yeah, of course,
it's on every episode. There's 10 questions. We want to give those 10 questions to you now. Are you ready to go for those?
Yeah. Can they be X-rated or
absolutely
R-rated?
There's no answer that's going to be cut. So that's the nice part about it. All right. So let's get this started. What is your favorite word, sir?
To be honest with you, it's probably fuck.
Yeah, that's always right at the head of the pack, I think.
Excuse my French, yeah, but it probably is.
No, that's not a problem. What about the opposite? What's your least favorite word?
Probably that one, too.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
It could go both ways.
That's true, depending on your attitude, I guess, right? Yeah. What turns you on?
My girlfriend.
What about the opposite? What turns you off?
Pushy, demanding people.
Yeah, me too. What?
Can't stand them.
Yeah, absolutely, agreed. What sound or noise do you love?
It's going to be hard to explain. I think my favorite noise or sound, and I go back to my childhood, I go back to the days I spent as a kid being at the ballpark. Mm. There was a certain way, and I never heard it again, but it was at Comiskey Park, which they knocked down back in 1991. But there was a certain way when the bat hit the ball, there was this certain, I can't even describe it, but I've never heard it again in another ballpark in my life, but it was always there. Mm. Just a sound that I've never heard. I've been to hundreds and hundreds of baseball games, never heard it again, but it was always at Comiskey Park. And I miss that so much. Never heard it again, ever, anytime at a baseball game in my life.
You know, just as a general sound, just the sound of a crack of a bat hitting a ball is just a beautiful sound. I love that sound anyway. So yeah.
But this was even more defined. You know, maybe I just picked up on it all the time, but I miss it and I love it so much. And I know I'll probably never hear it again.
Yeah. Unfortunate. What about the opposite? What sound or noise do you hate?
Oh, that's a good question. There's a lot of them.
there are.
sound or noise I hate. I have a friend who absolutely will not wear a seatbelt in the car. He doesn't care. And I'll get in a car with him. And he can let that thing go on for 3 hours.
Oh, the seatbelt noise.
Bing,
yeah.
Bing, bing. That drives me crazy. And I do wear my seatbelt. I always wear it. But my friend refuses, straight out refuses. Even Buckley, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
He would have a conversation with me, listen to music, talk on the phone. That thing's going on for three or 4 hours, maybe six. I don't even care.
Wow. That's got that takes a lot of patience, I think, to be able to just listen to that thing over and over. Okay, well, this might be a replication, but maybe we'll get a different one.
It's the same one.
Favorite curse word? Okay.
Yeah, it's the same
one. So we'll skip that one. What about, I will skip that. So the next two, I'm really interested to hear from you. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I always wanted to be an archaeologist. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
At a young age, I always loved that, you know, digging up stuff, whether it was dinosaurs or, you know, mummies. I mean, I would have loved to have done it. I would have loved to have attempted it. It fascinates me. I try and watch everything on it. You know, it would have been a great job to have. I mean, I don't think it pays a lot unless you find something cool.
Yeah.
But it looked really neat to me.
Agreed, 100%. What about the opposite? Yeah. What profession would you not like to attempt?
I would not want to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
No chance, no way. It's a tough job to do. There's part of them are scumbags, part of them are not. And I don't think I'd want to go anywhere near that job or even learn how to do it. That would not happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, the last question of the night, maybe the most profound. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
He probably would say wrong door. You're supposed to go down.
Well, on that note, Steve, tell us.
It's a good note to leave it on.
It is. Tell us where we can all follow you online, where we can find out more about your work. Give us some plugs.
Sure. Obviously Twitter, where usually I just rant about the Chicago Bears. and I believe it's Steve_grad. And then obviously on Instagram, which is the real Steve Grad. And then if you search Facebook, I have a fan page I update once in a while. It's just under my name, Steve Grad. Or, you know, obviously just tune into Pawn Stars Mondays, and it's on tonight. So, and I think next week starts the new kind of episodes of the season. They do these breaks. I don't even understand it. And I don't know how they do it. I have no clue, but it's taken me a long time to even understand how they come up with all of it. But you could see me on there at any time. Obviously you could reach out to me on any of my social media. I'll try and answer it. My personal Facebook, I usually don't, but if you contact me otherwise, I try and get back to everybody I can. So,
yeah. And links to everything we discussed tonight in the show notes. You know, I've been watching you in the show for some time, as so many people have probably told you, but being able to chat with you tonight a little bit tonight it's been a true pleasure. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Greatly appreciate it. And I will do it anytime. Maybe next time get some, you know, even more cool questions. There's gotta be more.
Always.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meandmyfriendspod. And on Instagram, search the handle @meandmyfriendspod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes and rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson.
Tonight, the podcast featured the original song Defective by producer Redeman.
The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc. and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2020. All rights reserved.